This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This man was born in rural Australia, and while his passion for farmland is evident in the very way we relate to him, it was his soiree on reality television that made him a household name. First appearing on Australian TV, we got to know this gay man when he entered the Big Brother house in 2006. He then continued to make a splash on Dancing with the Stars, proving his popularity with the LGBTI and wider audience. However, it was his passion for dogs and his love of the land that has taken him on the road, touring the country with dog shows that has proven his popularity is near and far. While his big heart and open hand has been evident to most, his story has always been unique with a sense of mystery as to who he really is, beyond being a gay farmer with model good looks. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome David Graham, otherwise known as Farmer Dave, to Word for Word.
I think in my travels around the world, I have more in common with Mongolian nomads than I do with people in my own country.
David's childhood was tough.
It was really a case of not knowing that there was a world beyond my world.
I think David always felt that he was never going to achieve anything like his father or never get his father's approval.
I didn't think that I was gay at all. More was that as I matured, that admiration of men that was inside me turned more and more to actual attraction.
This is Big Brother.
But now you're looking for a life partner. Would you say that you're going into the house as a search for love?
It's time to go, David.
You know, David Graham desperately wanted to get out of the Big Brother house, but you, the audience, kept voting him in.
Good morning to the dancing farmer, David Graham.
Because we all feel things. I mean, at the heart, we all humans are tribalist.
Can you tell me where the nickname Farmer Dave came from?
Well, to be totally honest with you, I used to be called Country Dave. And back in the days of Nokia 5110s, when you shorten things, it doesn't shorten down so well. So I was glad when people started calling me Farmer Dave.
Right.
But yeah, I used to be Country Dave. And yeah, I'll leave that to your own thoughts and imaginations, what I'd be in people's phones as.
Sorry, are you talking about Grindr and...
No, just my normal mates, like, you know.
So you were Country Dave in everyone's phones?
Of course, yeah. Country Dave, and then as I became, like, full-on an actual farmer in my own right, I wasn't just working on my dad's farm, and I was farming completely, yeah, then everyone just started calling me Farmer Dave.
Do you think in some way that you get fetishized? Do you know how, like, some people get fetishized? Do you think because you're a farmer and, like, you're not really bad to look at, I'm just going to say this right now, but do you get fetishized because of that?
That ship has sailed. Do I get No, not at all. No, and no, definitely not. And like I try those apps, but 99% of the time I get weird messages back and so you just give up for a few years and I'll try again and you get weird messages back. You know, people assume that, I don't know, because you do a bit of TV work and you do a bit of this and you do a bit of that, you would not need to use those apps when I'm the exact candidate that needs to use those apps because, you know, I live a life where I'm not around other humans at all.
You need those apps more than anyone.
Yeah, totally, totally. So,
although I have to say this to you. So Andy Cohen, who is a TV presenter in America and is really well known, he's a gay man and he's in his 40s. And they were asking him the other day, and he definitely uses apps, even though he has that level of notoriety, because he said, a man's got to eat. At the end of the day, regardless of your circumstance, you still have the same needs as everybody else.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I'm usually nowhere near anyone that I can meet anyone in the normal ways, just because that's my lifestyle that I lead. So it's the only way often that I can meet other people. And so I'm very fortunate that my work does take me into foreign countries. And finally, I can, you know, be who I am and realise that I'm not as bad as I think I am in my own head. So it's good when I get to travel.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about this as we go on, but I want to talk about your beginnings, so where you grew up. Now, you were born in Gundawindi, is that right?
I'm from near Gundawindi, yeah. I'm 120 kilometres northwest of Gundawindi. It's our closest town. I'm a full-on Queenslander.
Yeah, really?
It's one of those things you should never ask someone if they're a Queenslander. If they are, they will tell you, and if they're not, you don't want to embarrass them.
What do you think of when you think of a Queenslander?
Absolutely awesome. For me, Queenslanders are the quintessential Australians. We are different. We've got a different system of government. We've got a different system of community. We're very different, especially, like, you know, we're in Victoria now and your whole population lives in Melbourne. You've got a few people out there somewhere in the bush. Maybe there's someone next to the Mallee Fowl, I don't know, collecting eggs. Someone's in Gippsland milking a cow. But in Queensland, more of the population lives outside of the capital city. So we are very much so a different people, and that's what I love about Queensland, the kindness that you get from the general population. The idea that you've got to help people out is so ingrained in our culture, and also the fact that we love our state. It's just so intense in all of us. And, you know, we also, the system of government that we have means that we have very long, stable governments for very long periods of time, which, you know, it's the opposite federally. You just, everyone gets a Guernsey. It's one of those things. Queensland culture is very different, and it's a culture that as soon as I'm back there, I feel at home. Like, I do a lot of teaching of children now, and I teach children a lot about our culture and about traditions that go back all those thousands of years. And I'm teaching kids in Sydney.
Yeah.
I'm teaching kids in Melbourne, but I'm having a conversation in Queensland with the children there. And that's what I love about Queensland, is that we're still so well in touch with who we have been for a very long period of time. Whereas there's just a genuineness that comes from Queensland, and that genuineness can often be seen not as authenticity, but as, you know, racism or bigotry and all this sort of stuff. And it's sometimes it's more about being okay by saying something and thinking that you'd be devious if you don't. Because we all feel things. I mean, at the heart, we all humans are tribalist.
Mm.
That's why we're having this conversation. I'm a tribalist being a Queenslander. We all are. It's naturally within our genes. I feel that Queenslanders are open and honest about it. And I feel like a lot of other people are not.
Can you tell me what your childhood was like then?
Different. Totally and utterly different to, I think, 99% of the world. I think in my travels around the world, I have more in common with Mongolian nomads than I do with people in my own country. So I grew up on a station, so 45,000 acres when I was first around. And then, of course, we grew up to about 100,000 acres. And it was really a case of not knowing that there was a world beyond my world. So we weren't in a cult, but I didn't know that there was people beyond it. I mean, I remember when the nuns, because, you know, we have a bush school. It's just a little school in the middle of a bush block. And there was 30 kids at the entire school. And we didn't know about anything. I mean, we had Aboriginal kids and there was white kids there, but we didn't know the difference. And the only thing that I knew is, and this is what I was told, and you only know what you get told when you're a little kid and everything you take literally, they were just longer in the oven. And that's all I knew. And, you know, we had staff on the farm that were Aboriginal, but I didn't know that they were different. And I remember at school that we were watching a documentary, and it was about Papua New Guinea, because, of course, Papua New Guinea used to be a colony of Queensland and subsequently Australia. And it only got independence in 1949. 74 or 5, I think, I can't remember. But we're watching a documentary on the New Guinea people, and at the end of it, Mrs. Bogle turned off the television, turned the lights back on, and she said, "Oh, you know, what do you see about some differences between them and us?" And this kid put his hand up and he said, "Well, they're black and we're white." And he was an Aboriginal kid. So the thing is that we were just so innocent to the idea of the differences that we see in ourselves. We were all the same. We're all the kids from Moonee. And the only time that we really knew that we had differences is when we had to do religious education, and the Catholics went one way and the Protestants went another way. And we would talk amongst ourselves, "What are the Catholics doing?" And then, you know, it's like, "Oh, they eat people. You know, they drink people's blood." And but then we'd all get after the religious class, we'd all get back together. This. And we're doing this, of course, under a tree, and they're under another tree on the other side of the school building. So it's just, it's hilarious. And that's why I say my life was so different, because, like, I'm seeing your face and you're like, "What the hell, man?"
No, but
we're the same age.
But it's exactly the same as what you first mentioned it as. I mean, it's very tribal. Do you like to feel like you're in a community?
Yeah, absolutely. But if I don't feel safe, I'll do whatever I can to change that. You know, so I've lived in full-blood Aboriginal communities. I've lived up in Wick country in Aurukun, and yeah, you feel so safe. But then, of course, there's one thing that you can bring into that community, like alcohol, and suddenly, you know, you're locked in your donga because someone's got an axe trying to get in. But then the next day, it's the alcohol's dried out and the friendship's back exactly where it was. And that's one of the peculiarities about rural Australia, be it an Aboriginal community or a white community or, now Tongan communities, which are probably springing up all over the place down here in Victoria. Just in those agricultural communities, there isn't always an underbelly. It is very much so a case of it's daylight and it's darkness. And, you know, we have a lot of problems, and I think as long as we're always honest about it, you know, violence that occurs up there, and my childhood was a very, very violent one, it's just the way it was, and yet so much love at the same time. It's a peculiarity, and you have so much freedom, but then again, you can be such a slave, and it's all happening at the one time, and that's the bizarre juxtaposition that creates us Queenslanders as being such, especially rural Queenslanders, are being such people that seem to have such outlandish views. But then at the same time, if anyone gets to know Queensland, they're like, "They're the most decent people, but then they say this stuff." It's like, well, that's because, you know, we grow up in this strange environment. Like, I was so free to run around my farm. But at the same time, when you're a little kid that's, you know, 5 and 6 years old, that has to run home to the homestead because you got left up the paddock, that's 22 or 23 kilometres, and you've got to run down a highway, and there's that idea that someone's going to come and take you all the time because you're a little kid that's running by yourself. Of course, that would never happen in the city. You wouldn't have a little kid that would have to run 20 kilometres back home.
No. No. I don't think anyone's leaving their children kilometres away from their home. With you, it always dawns on me that the saying, "If these walls could talk," because from what I know of you, you kind of drift in and out of places, and you're on an exploration like nobody else I've ever come across. What would you say David was like then as a child?
Totally and utterly innocent. It was a case of always survival. I mean, you know, I was born in 79, so grew up right through the 80s. So it was right in the middle of the Bjelke-Petersen era, where it was more like North Korea. You know, we'd all line up whenever a politician would come to an area. We'd all be on a dusty paddock and we'd all be in line, and they would land their plane and they'd come out and inspect us all, and we'd sing Advance Australia Fair or God Save the Queen. And I preferred God Save the Queen because I could remember the words. The rest of them, I was just confused.
Little did you know you'd end up becoming quite familiar with Queens at some point in your life. Maybe that's where it is.
Yeah. But no, I think, I was a very innocent and naive kid, and I had a thirst for knowledge, which was crazy for me. I mean, the books we had in our house were religious books. You know, my family is quite religious, like many rural families back then, not so much now, of course, but definitely back then, very religious. We rarely ever had television that would work because the bloody cockatoos would destroy the aerial every time we'd put it up, and it had to be, you know, 30 metres up in the air because we were down in a river valley. So the books that we had in the house were Christian ones or they were encyclopedias. We had 1967 set of Encyclopedia Britannica, and I read every single book 1,000 times. And that is what allowed me to know that there is a world that's outside of the station that I grew up in.
Your curiosity is what makes you, in a way. I think that's your driving force, is your curiosity.
Absolutely, yeah. And money is not my driving force, that's for sure. So here I am, almost 40, and, you know, I don't have a dollar to my name.
Wow. Tell me about this relationship that you then had with your parents. And a lot of gay men have an affinity and have a closeness to their mothers. Did that happen for you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I was the youngest of 11 children, so I have 5 brothers and 5 older sisters, so everyone's older, and I came along right at the end. So there was a hell of a lot of pressure on me, because although I come from a Scotch-Irish background, we have to succeed because we are built out of a culture of adversity. You're in the wrong spot.
Sure.
Pretty much, and everyone around you wants you dead, so you have to succeed and do a lot of good stuff.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I definitely came from that culture, even though it's only my dad's line, very much so. It's that immigrant, you must do as best as you can, because God smiles on the Protestant work ethic type thing. So work when nobody's watching, and always have a smile on your face when they are, and never complain about your lot in life. That's definitely the culture I was brought up in, but there was a lot of love, but I was definitely brought up to take on the family farm. You know, my brothers were all farmed off by the time that I was coming along, and they had their own farms that my dad had created for them. My sisters were getting married off, as you do in the culture, and there was me that was going to be left with the farm. And because, you know, my parents are quite elderly when I came along for the time. I mean, dad was almost 50 and mum was 40. So there was a lot of pressure on the fact that I was going to take on the farm. And well before I went to school, I was working 12-hour days. So no matter how good I was at school, I'm going to take on the farm. So my dad actually resented when I did well at school. And that was always a major conflict in the household that I couldn't understand, because when I leave my farm, it's always, if you do well at school, you're really good. The world rewards people who learn and use that knowledge to better themselves or to better our community. Whereas when I got back to the farm, my dad would be extraordinarily upset about if ever he saw me reading a book, if ever he saw me doing any academic work, and he would really humiliate me about any academic success that I had.
Has your dad ever said he loves you?
Funnily enough, he did the night that I got out of Big Brother.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're both emotional people, so you say that to me and I'm like, all right. It's okay. But he did. It's so like...
He did.
And that was down the line on the phone, or was he there?
No, he was there. He was there, and it was all very bizarre. And they were locked away in a room, and so they didn't know what had gone on stage or anything like that. And, of course, we didn't have television at home, so my dad didn't see any of the show at all, had no concept of what was going on. But he did have a concept, of course, of how the community in our region was reacting to it all. And, you know, I wasn't out before I went on the show, and I wasn't, as I say, Queenslanders are open and honest. I wasn't myself open and honest, and that's the one time that he said it, so yeah.
How can you be open and honest in a community like that, though, where in lots of ways you are being suppressed? And also, the one thing that people might not necessarily know about you is that you're an empath. Like, you're somebody who does want energy from other people, and you want to do the right thing by them.
Of course, yeah.
And I think that culmination really comes together when it comes to your father, because you are looking to make him happy.
Yeah.
But then you still have to be true to yourself.
Absolutely.
And you still have done that, which I think is what a lot of people probably would have just gone, well, this is my lot in life. You know, I live on the farm and I'm going to get married and I can have kids. And I mean, you still have a quest for your own story, which is powerful.
Well, there was only two options that we ever had. It was end it or get married and have kids and make this poor woman miserable, because every partner knows if they're not right for you. So you're going to ruin her life. And of course, you're not going to be able to be the best dad, because there's always this resentment within you as a male. And so you see that. You see these poor gay men that are forced into that situation, and that's why most of the people in the bush used to just top themselves, because that's what our culture expected of us and that's what we expected of ourselves.
If you, like, you've got children. And so, how many kids have you got?
I've got three.
You have three children.
Three gorgeous girls. They are.
Is that because women look at you and they're like, alrighty, good stock?
No, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I actually met the first mother of my donor, two donor girls, and I was emceeing an event for Open Doors, which is a wonderful organisation that helps young people get through life and stay alive. And it was about 10 or 12 years ago, and I was in the middle of doing a speech and celebrating their first year of operation and how many kids that they'd saved, and I'd done a lot of work with them. And then I saw this girl and I just said to her through the middle of my thing, I want to have babies with you, because I just felt it was so powerful. And then anyway, afterwards, when, you know, people come up and they say, oh, you know, you did a great job or whatever, she came up and she said, oh, did you mean what you said? And I said, yes, I want to have babies with you. And I said, I'm so sorry that I said that, and I can't believe I'm saying it again right now. But anyway, there we are, after a lot of hiccups and a lot of dramas, we the proud shared parents of two beautiful girls who actually had a week up in up on my farm, and they got to experience my country, and they got to share in the absolute adoration and love and everything that beats in my heart. They got to experience about coming back to their country, and even though they're not my kids, you know, they've got two beautiful mothers and they're very much so a family unit. Genes speak, and for me to have them come and swim in a billabong where people have been swimming for 20 or 30,000 years was so powerful for me. It was just last week, so it was beautiful.
That is so powerful. What is? We're getting ahead of ourselves, but I have to ask this question. What is it like to be a gay man in 2018 and to be able to hold a child that is your own? What does that feel like? I don't know what that feels like.
The most incredible thing ever. You hear it all the time. People say your life changes when you have kids. The moment, oh my God, and it's still to this day, like, I just became relaxed. It's like, yeah, it wasn't like I've done my job. It was like I'm now part of the chain. Whereas, you know, as a gay man, I always thought, well, I'm the end. There's this genetic chain that goes back 2 million years, and I've ended it. Like, I'm a rotten seed. And I'm not going to perpetuate this incredible story. I'm the end. I'm the last chapter. And that is pretty, pretty soul-destroying.
Well, it's fairly bleak, but at the same time, I think for you in particular, I think that it was inevitable that your roots, your vines, the way that you are as a person, weren't going to get entangled into this universe, and that there was going to be a bigger purpose. You were never going to be that seed that was left to rot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's just a part of who you are. So then, I cannot believe we went over this before, but is it 11? Are you part of 11?
Yeah, I'm the youngest with 11 kids.
So you're the youngest out of 11 children. What do they all think of you? I mean, what's the dynamic?
Look, I wasn't, you know, often people say the little one gets spoiled. That was definitely not the case. And because I had quite a lot of girls just above me, they're the ones that I interacted with. And, yeah, look, I was the punching bag for most of my family members. And, yeah, it was a pretty brutal, hideous childhood when it comes to looking back from a family point of view. It was a glorious childhood considering the country I lived in and the incredible freedom that I had to experience the bush and to exist off the land at times, because sometimes it was a little bit too hard to be at home. So, you know, you have that incredible inner resilience that was created out of that experience of having so many siblings that probably resented your existence.
Where does that resentment come from?
I think, like, my dad created a very adversarial attitude amongst us children, that we weren't all one. He would ensure that we competed against each other, and by the time I came along, you know, he'd done his dad duties. He was over it. He'd done all the footy stuff with my brothers. By the time I came along, he was just like, right, you're going to work. And, you know, I was operating 550 horsepower tractors at the age of six. You know, like, that's what I was doing. And there was no, from his point of view, reason that I needed to have a childhood.
It was mechanical. Like, he was going through the motions.
Yeah.
Training an instrument for a farm.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. When I look back, it was very much so a a slave type situation. I know that's a really harsh word, and those that are actual slaves to other humans might find that really offensive. But when I look back, that was the relationship.
I've seen both of your parents interviewed. I've seen them both talk candidly about your childhood, and they weren't pretending it to be something different.
Yeah.
Which I thought to them, you know, like that's, and my hat's off to them in a way.
Yeah.
Because quite often you see people say, oh no, that never happened, when they know it did.
Yeah.
So I think in lots of ways they're owning it.
And that's the glorious thing about all of my family, is that there is no shoving things so much under the rug, which is what you do get a lot with people that have violent households.
What's happening with them now? Like, what's your relationship with
Well, I've, you know, as you say, I do have a very close relationship with my mum. She's everything to me. She's the, up until 3 years ago, the only woman that I thought I'd ever really, truly love. But now that's extended, which is so strange for me. But I love that I've got these three beautiful daughters.
Isn't being surprised in the world the best thing in the world? You know, when you go, oh, I always thought this was going to be that. It's such a beautiful thing to go, oh.
Yeah, when you make your own journey, it's up to you what you do. And you know, that whole thing about there's only get married to a woman and have a terrible, terrible emotional life for everyone in your family, or just kill yourself, which is the two options that I had. I very much so realised, which was the motivating factor, to be as political in a very strange way that I was going into the reality TV space. So, it was very much so I learnt you can create your own path. And I'm glad I did because, you know, as I say, the two mothers and two of the girls spent a week up at the farm with me, and my dad loved them. He was running around playing an emu, and because emus, as you know, are brought up by their dads. And it was awesome. And my mum absolutely adored these little girls as much as she, and as equally as she does her hordes and hordes and hordes of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, of course. So, yeah, it's beautiful. And it's just a case of, if you accept the reality that people tell you there is, that's all you have. But create your own options. And that's what I have done so much with my life, is I don't agree with the status quo.
You're going to push against it.
I'm going to fucking push against it, but I'm going to open up a fucking door. And yeah, it's for me. Of course it's for me. No one does anything without their own
absolutely
needs to be met. A lot of people work in the charity space. I constantly work in the charity space, but still it's because it's for your own needs to feel good about yourself and to feel that community sense that we humans innately have, because we're a group creature. We're a herd creature that always has to help each other. We're doing it for our own needs. But at the same time, it was like, I don't want a kid to go through what I went through out in the fucking bush. And be that out in the bush or be that in the western suburbs of Sydney, if you feel isolated, you need to know that you're not alone. And
well, being isolated is being isolated.
Yeah, exactly.
So it doesn't matter where it's happening. All children need to be loved and have a purpose.
Yeah.
And that's a great place to look for it. I think it's really clear that in lots of ways, the country life really got under your skin, and that's who you are.
It's who I am. It's in every part of my DNA, yeah.
I would love to know, though, because of the environment, because you're a masculine gay man. Like, that's how you come across. Do you think because of the pressures that came from your dad and the culture of that, that's made you this way? Like, could you imagine if you were brought up in the city that maybe you could be more effeminate?
No. I am who I am, and I've tried. I've tried to be as gay as I possibly can be.
When?
I've worn a tutu. You know, it's just, at the end of the day, I'm not faking who I am. Like, yeah, you have...
This is truly who you are.
Yeah, this is unfortunately, this is who I am, and I can't change it. And as much as there are very, very effeminate gay men, there are very, very effeminate straight men.
Oh, absolutely. You know? But
and,
I think
it doesn't matter how your personality manifests itself out into the public. Sexuality is, I feel, is totally unrelated
to gender. Absolutely. I mean, people's gender and the way that they present themselves in their gender is so different to sexuality.
Yep.
But I was always curious, just because of your circumstance, being that I knew that you were around a very male needs to be male environment, whether that could be a driving force as to the way you've presented yourself. So taking sexuality out of the equation altogether, I'm just talking about the pressures that were on you to present as a straight masculine male.
I got a lot of mates that are from farms, and they were brave enough not to take the weak alternative of running ute into a tree, and they're very effeminate and gay as Christmas. So we come from the same culture. I got a lot of mates that are Roman Catholic or Presbyterian, and so they have that very extreme rural religious stuff put on them, plus of course all the breeding attributes, plus sure. the fact that, you know, you've got to take on the farm, you've got to breed, you've got to marry that neighbor down the road's daughter because, you know, they've got a really good boar. You know, or
Sharon down the road's got a really good boar.
yeah, you know, all that stupid stuff that we do in the sticks, whatever. It's as I say, there's more in common with a Mongolian nomad than there is with people in town. But look, maybe I would be a different if I grew up somewhere else, but I'm just who I am as and I've traveled enough and been around enough to be pretty damn comfortable in my skin right now, so I don't feel that I have to put on any acts anymore. And when you get close to 40, you just, I don't know, it's just one of those things that you just start to, after a while, go, I don't really give a shit.
Well, it's not important.
It's not important, and I luckily, you know, realise at quite a young age that no matter what I do, I ain't going to change someone's opinion unless I am authentic. And that's what I've tried to do with my life. And as much as, you know, I've very much been a very, very vocal political advocate to make people realise that you are not going to be hurt by allowing your gay child to be gay, get along with their life. What I've tried to do in this space is not run down the street with a placard and say, you need to change. What I've done is I'm not changing, and I'm showing anyone that would bother to look out for me or to search me, to show them that, you know, I'm just living my life. I'm a gay guy that just is farming and I'm doing my thing. I'm not making a huge big deal about it. Every now and again, yeah, okay, I get on the national media and jump up and down about something. But largely what I've tried to do is, instead of say, look at me, I'm gay and I'm proud and you should all change, I just said, hey, I'm me and you can accept it or not accept it, but I'm not going to change.
And I've got a story to tell. I've never, ever looked at it the way that I look at 99.9% of people that have been on reality television. I've never, ever put the magnifying glass over you and gone, oh, that's because he was looking for a little bit more. Like, I always just see you authentically having a conversation about something. And it's funny when people say that.
They go, oh, yeah, you went on TV because you wanted fame. It's like, man, when I was 19, I was on billboards right throughout Europe. You know, I was walking on catwalks with Hugo Boss. Like, you know, like, I did all that shit way before. And it was never for attention. It was just, that's the only way I could see the world. You know?
Yeah, you wanted to go and travel the world.
Yeah.
That was your version of backpacking.
Yeah.
Was being paid as an international model. Yeah. All right.
Well, look, I could never have left the farm any other way. And
what does Dad think about you being a model on a billboard?
Oh, my best mate and my girlfriend at the time, we had this plan to run away and see Sydney, because for us, Sydney was the city of sickness and wrongness, and everything that was wrong with the world was Sydney. You know, it was a cesspit. And we're like, do you really think it is? Let's go and
Let's check it out.
So we stole a car. And
went down the yellow brick road.
Yeah, we drove to Sydney. We did it all in a single day. And then we got in the middle of the night and we didn't know where to go or what to do. And we were hungry, so we went to McDonald's because, you know, it's freeway. Sure, we didn't eat or anything. Anyway, we got in about 2 o'clock. The only place that was open was a McDonald's on George Street. And we were served by Asians who spoke in an Australian accent. And that blew our minds because we're these stupid Queenslanders. And we were like, what the hell is going on? And then we went and parked somewhere and there was rats running around. We're like, oh my God, it's a cesspit. This place is alien forms. And yeah, it was very, everything that very strange. But yeah, I got picked up by, not picked up, but heaps of model scouts, which doesn't happen in real life. So there was 3 model scouts, right, that spoke to me as we were just exploring Sydney over the couple of days that we were running around and seeing what the city was all about. And then we were at Hyde Park where the fountain is, and my mate said, this is your ticket out, man. You can actually see the world.
Wow.
And I said,
I'll do it.
If it happens again, I'm going to do it. Yeah. And without a word of a lie, that moment, this guy came up, and this Italian chap, and he said, oh, I'm from Elite Models. And we're just there. My girlfriend, she fell over, and she's like, what the? This doesn't happen in real life. And so I'm like, well, I'd committed to it. And, you know, I was deeply Christian at the time. And so when you have a commitment like that,
yeah,
you got to see it through.
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then went back and signed all these papers on the day. And then they booked all my flights a week later. But I went home to see my parents and, of course...
Before you go.
Yeah, yeah, and return the car. And they're like, what have you done? What have we raised? You know, it's because of this friend that you have from the city. And then I told them what I was doing. Of course, after my friends... I dropped them off back in the city and driven back to the farm. And I remember when I told my mum, she cried for the entire week. And she actually got some of my uncles, who was my godfather as well, one of my uncles, to speak to me. And he'd done modelling and he'd done a lot of TV commercials. And he was a bit fancy because he writes books and all this sort of stuff. And he then talked to me about, you know, it's really the whole world is just about the modelling world. It's just a way to groom people for old gay men. So yeah, that's my first conversation I've ever had about gayness with anyone was my uncle saying, you know, this thing that you're doing, it's just, you're just becoming a, you're going to become a gay.
They're going to drag you into the gay world. Don't you think that probably comes from their fear because maybe they had assumed your sexuality before you told them?
No, sadly, no. No, because my dad then, when I did tell my dad that I was going, I put my hand out to shake his hand and he spat in my face and said that I was a narcissist and I was a stain on my family. Sadly, my parents didn't assume. And because a lot of people, you know, they have this wonderful story where they come out to their parents are like, baby, I already knew, but thank you for being open and honest with me. And I'm so glad that you were able to do it in your own time. I tried to tell my mum. She wouldn't. She's just like, it doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense. And I tried to tell her again. She's like, it doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense. And so that went on for about 6 or 8 months. And then, I got bashed up pretty bad by a gang in Brisbane and by a gay hate gang, actually. Anyway, I left the pub and these guys were throwing these bottles at these fellas. And they're like, oh, you fucking faggot, you fucking poof da. And I'm like, I'd had enough. The reason I was in Brisbane that night is because I'd been driving 11 days cultivating. And, you know, I do 20-odd hour days and I just camp in the cab of the tractor and I wake up and I drive again because you've got to get it all done with moisture and all this sort of stuff. You've really got to conserve your moisture and manage your moisture when you're doing a first till. Anyway, bloody, the whole time I'm on the tractor, you've got Bob Catter saying that the gays don't exist. And I was at that time an Anglican. And, of course, the Anglican faith was being ripped apart by the fact that the Americans were admitting gay bishops and gay priests and, you know, the diocese here in Australia was like, oh, my God, this is so wrong. Mm. So from every angle, from my religious angle, from my political angle, and I used to be quite heavily involved in the National Party at the time, and I was just so peppered by all of this stuff. And then a movie was being made about two gay farmers, and then of course you've got all these people ringing in saying, you know, how disgusting, how can they ruin our culture, thinking that we would do something like that. There's no such thing as gay farmers. And I'm like, motherfuckers. So I got in my ute and drove to Brisbane, and then so I was over being told that I don't exist, because I'd gotten to the point where I'm like, you know, I have to exist, motherfuckers, and don't can tell me that I need to go and drive my ute into a tree, because I tried that and it didn't can work, so I'm not going to do it again. Anyway, these f***s, they were throwing these beer bottles, and I just went up to him and I said, hey, what the f*** are you guys doing? He's not going to hurt you. Is he trying to reach you? And they're like, no, but he's a faggot. And and I just, you know, I was f***ing drunk as a skunk, but I'd had a gutful. I'd had a gutful of the world saying that there's something wrong with you, because I know there's nothing wrong with me. Mm. And at the time, I was religious, so I believed that God made me in his image and I had a right to exist like every other motherfucker had a right. So I said to these guys, I just calmed them down and they were all cool. And you know what? They were all having a good old chat with me at the end of it. And people were walking out past them, coming out of the pub, and it was all a very dark lit street in Brisbane. There's car yards all next to the Wickham Hotel. And so it's quite dark and there's a lot of trees. So it's pretty dark, but people were walking past. I'm like, see that guy there? He's not trying to hurt you. He's just trying to get to his car. Those two guys over there, they're probably going, you know what? That doesn't hurt you. That doesn't affect you. no one's, you're not going to get any spit. Yeah. It's not your mess to be involved in. And they're like, yeah. He's like, man, you're pretty cool. And I said, not bad for a faggot. And then the leader said to me, what do you mean? And then I said, I'm gay and I'm not hurting you, am I? And then that's when I got pelted from behind and got kicked and got smashed and they left me for dead, man. So, yeah. So me standing up saying, don't be mean, I'm here. I actually did feel what it's like to get killed by others after I'd tried to do it myself. So it was kind of like, we've got to stop hating ourselves. This is 2005, 2006 or whatever. And other people have got to stop hating us. And the only way to do it is to tell people, hey, you know what? We're not just the hairdresser.
Yeah.
We're not just the female footy player or the female cricketer.
I always say to people, there's more lesbians than the ones that go to Bunnings, and there's more gays than the guys that are Jack from Will and Grace. Like,
yeah.
I have to ask, if David walks into... So, like, this is a bit of a strange question. So, David walks into this room at the age of 12.
Uh-huh.
What advice do you give David?
Breathe, baby.
It's going to be a long ride.
Breathe in, breathe out, and repeat. Because what advice can you give to a young person? I mean, they have to live it. And I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change a f***ing thing. And I wouldn't, you know, I used to always want a time machine and always want to go back and change certain things. But no, you've got to experience it. And if you don't go through the trials and tribulations, you don't have the inner strength to face the next one or the next one or the next one.
Absolutely.
So I wouldn't say a thing. I would just look and go, oh, you're a bit skinny. Eat your steak and veggies, buddy.
I saw
a few more push-ups.
I saw a photo of you the other day with the big smile and the big eyes, but just you on this small kid's body. And it was so, I was just like, wow. And that's it's strange to even talk about it. But I have to ask then, are you happy at this time?
I'm definitely the happiest I've ever been, which is so extraordinary because I don't have any of the things that an Australian is supposed to have. I don't have a mortgage. I don't have a relationship. I don't have Christmas with my family. I don't have a 9-to-5 job. I do not have superannuation. But what I do have is the most extraordinary life where I feel I've done my bit to make my community, be it my farming community, be it my gay community, be it my Australian community, a better place. And I feel like I've given back and my slate is clean. So I feel very content that I don't owe anyone anything anymore.
I think it comes down to you being your truest self at this point, and maybe it's taken a while to get there.
Yeah, well, you know, I've spent my time in monasteries in the Himalayas and up doing dog sledding across the North Pole, and I've done a lot of things where the soul searching that often comes from other people's directions, like the Bible or the Quran or whatever meditation fad is going around, or vegan or paleo fad is going around. I don't have to follow those things simply because I have led a life that has exposed me to so many extremes of the human condition, as well as the environment that we humans haven't already manipulated, so that I really feel content and I don't need anything else.
It's a good place to be in. It's such a good place. And it's interesting, you said that you wouldn't take anything back, but both of us, as we've mentioned, had been on reality TV, same show, and I've met a lot of those people along the way, and they say that they regretted doing it. Where you're saying you've got no regrets.
It was the best. I could never have come out to my family in any other way.
Then do it on national television.
Yeah, I mean, look, when you run of 11 kids, remember the Telstra bills back then? That would have been a lot of phone calls. So, no, I don't regret it. And
would you do it again now, though? Would you go back and, if they were to do an All-Stars Big Brother, would you go back and do it now?
It would be a difficult one because I have so many dogs and...
They can't go into the show.
They can't come into the show.
They might put one. But the reason why I ask you that question in particular, though, is I'd love to know your idea on what is the biggest differences between the David we saw at 2006 go into that program versus 2018. You know, what is... what Australia would see that is vastly different.
Well, I had a lot to say back then. I wanted not to change the world, but I wanted the world just to open their eyes a little bit. I wanted to get into the lounge rooms of the 2.5-3 million people, and I wanted them to just accept that they had certain values or they had certain morals and maybe, just maybe, change them. Be it for the good or be it for the worse, but at least have that inner conversation with themselves and maybe with their family members as well, which
they did.
Which they did, and I'm probably the only person in Australia of the homo persuasion that thinks that in the same way the plebiscite was that same style of conversation that we had to have. And
how does that... but. Do you know what's so interesting that you've made this point?
Mm.
Is that my biggest problem with the plebiscite is the stories and the people that I knew in regional areas that were affected. I had friends, I had a person that I knew from Central Queensland that killed himself, and that was that they ran a no campaign. They spent $1 million more on a no campaign, which killed people. It put it like it was one of the worst things. We will that effect of that plebiscite will happen for so long.
It's taken the band-aid off. And I know it sounds so f***ing rough, but it took the band-aid off. And it allowed us to heal. The first capital punishment that was brought into Australia was for sodomy. Like, that was the first capital punishment. I mean, we don't have capital punishment, thank goodness, in Australia now. We don't have legalised, sanctioned government murder, but we did. And one of those things that you could be murdered by the government for was sodomy, for being gay. We needed to rip that band-aid off. And we can now walk down the street and know that a majority in our democracy, without question, say that we should exist and we should live. And it's no different to the 1967 referendum, where are these fauna or are these people? And as terrible as it was, Australia said no. The dozens and scores of nations that were here before the British arrived, they are people. They're not fauna, they're people. And they should be included like the rest of us. And I felt no different with the plebiscite. The plebiscite for me allowed me to look every single person in the eye that has ever said that I don't exist or that I don't belong, and I go, eat that cupcake up. Because you know what? You don't get to say to me that I don't exist anymore. You don't get to say to me that Australia doesn't believe in me, because this is a democracy. And a massive majority said, you know what? We've had a very long conversation about this. We've had every f***ing religious string pulled at our hearts. We've had every cultural string pulled at our hearts. And we've had every tradition, because we're all told, oh, this is just a slippery slope. Despite all of that, Australia said, yeah, nah, they're okay. They should be treated equal. And for me, that just allows me to be so happy, because there is no question anymore. You can never have a person say, oh, well, the politicians just did it because the gays run the show, or the gays run the media, or the gays run the parliament, or the gays are all the mafia. That no one can ever say that. It's done, and it is dusted, and it is finished with. We can never bring this issue up again. It's one of those things that was the most painful. For me, living in the bush was the most painful thing, because remember, we say what we feel.
Yeah.
The Queensland bush, you say it. And I had people all the time saying, you know, Dave, I love you, mate, but it's all them other ones. And what are they going to make us do next? You know, they're not all like you, mate. And it's like when you go back to your post office and you get that vote, just ask yourself this one question. Am I as equal as you? And if you say I'm not, then right, no. But if you think that I am, don't think about the people that imagine exist, like the Christian lobby imagined that there's all these evil gays out there that are just trying to make us all start to make love with rabbits and
marry the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Just answer that question with the people that you know. And should everyone be treated equally in this country? And if the answer is yes, then fucking say yes. If the answer is no, then say no. But live with it for the rest of your fucking life. And I'd say that to every
Absolutely. Look, I'm not saying... Do you know what's so interesting about you, David, though, is that I know that you are quite political in the sense that you've been quite involved with the National Party and you have a voice, you have an opinion, and they are your own and you back it, which is very rare amongst politicians, I believe, in the culture of politicians right now. Is politics something that you've put to bed?
I've given it a kip. And the reason I gave it a good long kip was the most attacked I got was from urban gay people. Yeah.
What's happening with the Nationals?
So I'm totally not involved at all.
And is there a story to go with the reason why you're not involved? Because that's what I want to know.
Oh, yeah. The religious right did everything they possibly could to kick me out. Which you know, there's a lot of gay people in the National Party now and openly gay, and it's a very broad spectrum. But then at the same time, how do you get headlines? You've got to say ridiculous things, and not all those politicians believe in what they say, but you need to get airtime, because if you don't get airtime, you don't get elected. That's just the way democracy works. You need to have as many people as possible listening to what you have to say, because hopefully some of those people will end up going, that resonates with me, I'll vote for that person. That's the tragedy of democracy, is that you've got to say ridiculous things to get the media to get your message out there. Otherwise, you know, it's just a case of how else are you going to do it? I mean, Donald Trump, hello, you know.
What about Barnaby Joyce? Because he was a big supporter of yours at one point.
Definitely was an amazing supporter and spoke very graciously for my Australian story, and top bloke.
What happened to him? He's at the slippery slope.
Well, he's a hypocrite. He's a hypocrite. And that's why I don't have religion for me personally anymore, because I have a huge issue with people that live their lives cherry picking and pointing fingers. And the whole idea of Christianity, which is what drew me to it in such an extreme way when I was young, was the idea that you should treat everyone kindly and always find your own faults before you even bother picking out anyone else's. And unfortunately, the Christians we have today are as far removed from the teachings of their leader as you could possibly get. I mean, the whole teachings of Jesus are very, very much so turn the other cheek. And these guys are warmongers saying, I'm a Christian soldier. It's like, you can't, that's not what he was about. He was about saying, you know, if someone's downtrodden, you lift them up. If someone's poor, give them your cash. A camel has more ability to get through the eye of a needle than a rich man into heaven. And yet all these Christians are all about the cash and the money and turning away asylum seekers and economic migrants. It's just bizarre. We've all got to, I think, get to that point where, you know, we've just got to be okay in our own skin and stop fueling and ripping apart other people and just be like, well, that person just said that. I agree with that.
Well, I think it's living outside our own circumstance is the biggest thing that's a problem from where I'm sitting.
Oh, the bubble.
Where it's like, I'm living in this privileged white man's land.
Yeah.
You know, and we see it in smaller communities. We see it in the LGBTI community. There's white gay men who are extremely privileged, not sending, like, not putting some light over other factors, facets, you know, of the community. So, look, these are problems that we obviously need to have. You know, what is happening for you at the moment? What's going on?
Well, so I spend all the Christmas holidays and all the major public holidays teaching kids about food, fibre and fuel and where it all comes from and how we can actually be a sustainable people and just connecting those kids to their country and getting them to understand. I mean, they get to hold grinding wheels that come from my land and my country that have been used for tens of thousands of years.
Sure.
We grind up some damper, we make some damper, we talk some Dreamtime stories. I get them to understand that our culture goes on well beyond the arrival of the First Fleet and or well beyond the arrival of their parents or even themselves. Our history goes back and we need to embrace it.
Don't you love looking at kids when you're giving them information, when you can see them being a sponge?
Because like, it scares the out of me how easy it is to be a terrible Roman Catholic priest and or any pedophile, because, you know, I went to that Anglican school where the Governor General lost his job over all the pedophilia that was happening. It is so easy. They just love you. And when you share with something with them and you're honest with them, they just adore you. It is so easy to be a horrid human being, but how you could be a horrid human being to a child, I cannot comprehend.
Have you got a message for the queer community that would be listening to this right now?
Live your own f***ing life. Live your own f***ing life. If you're in Altona, if you're in Ipswich, if you're in Kawanyama, live your own f***ing life. No one has the right to tell you how to live your life. And as long as you don't hurt anyone, you're doing it right.
Well, Farmer Dave, David Graham, thank you for giving me the most amount of explanatives, you know, in a chat so far. Thank you so much for taking the time and being so generous with your time and coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for telling the stories that you tell, Ben. And I listen to your podcasts as I travel right around Australia, and they are so insightful. And what you are doing for all of us is brilliant, because the more stories we share, the more open we become and the more okay we are with each other. So thank you.
Amazing. We are done.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.